Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
We are here. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston representing Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics. Postalnomics, if you are so inclined. How are you, Brandon?
Might have to get in touch with the U.S. Patent and Trademarks Office and maybe get a filing going on that.
It's on my to-do list. We have a very busy show. We didn't know what we were going to be talking about today, but one thing that is usually secure is that by Wednesday, we have a whole host of items to discuss. So we will be getting into all of that. But before I forget, I'm going to mention right off the top that if you are sitting at your laptop, computer, maybe you're listening to us in your earbuds, and I know what you're saying. Man, I wonder what John Pollock and Brandon Thurston would sound like in person. Well, if you are here in Toronto on Saturday, July the 6th, you are going to get such a question answered because we have assembled the Pro Wrestling Media Panel discussion chat that we are going to have as part of the cash-in event that Post Wrestling and Poison Rana is putting together at Yuck Yucks on 224 Richmond Street West in downtown Toronto, just a short walk from the Scotiabank Arena, the site of Money in the Bank that night. We're going to be doing a panel chat right off the bat at 2 p.m. that day. Brandon Thurston, Wei Ting, Stephanie Chase, and Benno from the Grapple podcast. We're going to be on stage. We're going to be chatting about many different topics within the media, several guests that will be in attendance to be determined. So we hope to see many of you out there. If you want to pick up a ticket, postwrestling.com/live. Free autographs from myself, Brandon Thurston.
Autographs.
I don't know what his rate is, but I'm sure you can coax him into at least a signed Excel spreadsheet. If you bring it, you have to supply the print.
Yeah, I don't really do autographs anymore, but if you print out an Excel spreadsheet and you want me to sign it, I will consider it.
So that is coming up, the cash-in on July the 6th, which is going to be the WWE's next premium live event. And we will have presence at the next three events between all of us. We have got this coming Saturday, Clash at the Castle in Glasgow, Scotland. And I guess we can mention it here. WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling, we have put our thinking caps together.
Brandon, you have to say it in French, though. You have to announce it in French.
Oh boy, I would have to be going back to my elementary school and first 2 years of high school education, which I was not that bad in French. I actually got an A in French in grade 9 and 10. But Lucas Charpio, man that had taken the world by storm after the Backlash France event, he is going to be representing both of our outlets this coming weekend in Scotland. He will be there on the ground attending the event and attending the post-show press conference, which we did confirm with a spokesperson from WWE. The press conference is happening as of about an hour ago, as I was told. And they are also doing some kind of post-show as well, whatever that will entail. But that's all coming up this weekend. And we're tentatively planning to have Lucas. He will be doing both written work for both of our sites and appearing on this show next Wednesday, and we'll do a whole rundown of the events as they unfold in Scotland.
Yes, looking forward to that. We were discussing earlier today. his article that he's going to be working on.
All right. So check out all of that work in the coming days. But let's dive into things. And we're going to start off with the latest concerning the Janelle Grant lawsuit. This past week, well, last week we discussed that there was a request made by the plaintiff side to put a stay or a hold on the civil case that was filed back in January, allowing for the federal investigation to continue and be uninhibited by an ongoing civil suit. And we got a ruling from Judge Jeffrey Mayer this past week stating that they have approved this stay for 6 months, and therefore this case can be picked up again in December, and this clears the way for the federal investigation, the little that we know about it, to continue. And I guess any other takeaways from this? A lot of these documents that were filed are sealed, but we did get at least some insight onto the at least key notes as it relates to the ongoing status of the case.
Yeah, these, as you said, there's these filings that we've got most recently, the last three have been sealed. And there's also on May 30th, there were those two sealed filings that were filed by an attorney from the Southern District of New York. But this, we can at least read this fairly lengthy docket entry that is, you know, looks to be written by the judge, just saying that he's approving the stay for 6 months, putting the date potentially, I think these things could change, but potentially at December 11th. And he has for now denied the motions to compel arbitration, but that doesn't really mean anything in the long term because it's a denial without prejudice, which means that they could pick back up on those motions when this civil case becomes active again.
So for the next 6 months, it's really a waiting game on the side of the federal investigation to see what movement is made, if any charges are actually laid. It's worth noting there have not been any charges, but we've been aware of this federal investigation for a long time. WWE has disclosed as such. We've spoken about that aspect. But man, Brandon, getting information out of the feds. I mean, these are, it's trying times.
Yes. We've been in touch with their PR representative as well, but they don't have much to say at all. We do know, according to the Wall Street Journal, their report from February, I'll get the exact date here, February 2nd, the headline was federal prosecutors investigate Vince McMahon sex trafficking allegations. And there's, you know, reports in as part of this article, back in February from Joe Palazzolo, Khadija Safar, and Ted Mann that, they were investigating sex assault, sexual assault, and sex trafficking allegations against Vince McMahon that they had interviewed a number of women. And we know from WWE, as of last summer, that Vince McMahon was served with a subpoena and a search warrant. WWE said at the time that they were cooperating with the investigation. So that's all we really know about the investigation. Now, we did get a comment yesterday from a spokesperson for Vince McMahon who said to WrestleNomics, Mr. McMahon is eager to prove Ms. Grant's claims are false and expose her lies, but did not object to the government's request to pause the matter in connection with the investigation regarding disclosures at WWE following the 6 month stay. When his legal team is able to get discovery and depose Ms. Grant and others, the evidence will show the relationship was consensual and Ms. Grant's allegations are malicious fabrications of a jilted lover, end quote. So they're referring only to investigation regarding disclosures, which would presumably refer to the whole hullabaloo we went through in summer of 2022 about these NDA payments to various women. There was also some Donald Trump compensation that was a part of that that were not reported as expenses that WWE itself determined should have been reported as expenses. And that's what this quote from a Vince McMahon spokesperson is alluding to here.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow whatever news is made over these coming months. But at least from the civil case, it would seem that for the next 6 months, things will be relatively quiet, but you can't really decipher, like, it's basically as it states, it's on pause and all of this can just resume come December and we're right back where we started and the case for the defendants to take this to arbitration will still be their objective, you would assume.
Yep. And I think what everybody is thinking about is will there be some charges that do get filed sometime in this 6 month window, but we don't know.
WWE, as we mentioned, are off to Scotland this week. They are going to be holding SmackDown followed by Clash at the Castle at the OVO Hydro Friday and Saturday, which means that you will likely be able to watch SmackDown in the afternoon if it magically pops up, which is always a nice break from having to watch SmackDown in the evening. And then we go to the premium live event.
Is that available on Peacock, that early broadcast of SmackDown?
It's available through a ways
of means. Fox? It's on FS1 or something?
It's on a broadcaster of some sort. Makes its way to certain sites, as you may or may not be aware. But we have got the lineup that, as of now, I mean, it's interesting to look at. This is going to be another probably rabid audience, another big international show that they have, although they did scale this for an arena setting, and they're not quite at capacity, although Saturday show is very, very close to it. I'm sure it's going to be full for Saturday and close to it on Friday. But once again, it's another international show, and it is going to be a very highly priced one when it comes to tickets and what they're going to be able to derive revenue-wise for the show.
So the cheapest ticket on Ticketmaster right now is 247 Great British pounds, which is about $350 US, I think, when you put the exchange rate in. But it'll be interesting to see if this, you know, challenges their sort of all-time arena gate record, which is currently held by Backlash, I understand, which broke the record that was set last year in London for Money in the Bank, you know, somewhere well over $3 million.
You starve these international fans, and then you come back and you just hike up these prices, and that's how you set record gates. Not to delve too far away from this, but it is remarkable to me that we are 2.5 weeks from this UFC pay-per-view at the T-Mobile Arena, where they are set to set their gate record of over $20 million. And there is still great concern that this fight may not happen between Conor McGregor and Michael Chandler after last week's press conference was canceled at the last minute. And there, it just seems to have been waves of optimism that the fight is still on. There's nothing to worry about. There's feelers being sent out about potential replacements. And you also
Why would the fight not happen?
No one knows what the source of this is, like why this press conference didn't happen. What is going on with Conor McGregor? Is this fight happening? Is this what kind of a dispute is this? Is this an injury related problem? Like there's just very little in terms of what's being disclosed. And while you wouldn't expect the UFC to be necessarily transparent in this case, you also have an athletic commission that at their core function, it is protection of the consumer, and you have people flying from all over the place at extraordinary prices that they are spending, still selling tickets, and you do not even have the company flat out stating this fight is on, there is nothing to worry about. You're just going off of, well, hopefully this fight is happening in 2.5 weeks.
And what is their gate record that they might break?
The previous record was $17.7 million.
The MSG
in 2016, another Conor McGregor fight. That was the Eddie Alvarez fight, set just days after the start of the Trump administration. And here we are all these years later. And this gate is reportedly to be in excess of $20 million.
At an arena,
yes.
Right.
And not a cheap ticket. And I don't know if there's any replacement if a Conor McGregor were not able to fight. That would be satisfactory. But yeah, that's where the status is. I mean, you feel that most likely this fight will be happening, but I don't know if you'd feel so confident if you spent thousands of dollars on tickets to, most likely I'll get to see this fight.
Card subject to change. I mean,
that's what happens.
You buy at your own risk. But I always think it's remarkable to point out that, you know, they're going to potentially draw a $20 million gate, and that will be more than any WWE gate ever in any kind of venue. And they're going to do that in an arena. What is it, T-Mobile?
Yes. That's WWE. I'm sure they're going to try their hardest to take their arena business to that same level.
If you're upset about WWE ticket prices, just be glad it's not UFC.
There is a huge chunk of fan bases that are like, this is going to be a television only product for you, that going to a major show. I don't think you're going to be completely cut out of live event attendance, but you know, to attend a UFC pay-per-view or a big WWE show, like you are moving more and more towards, like you are going to be priced out of that option, where once upon a time, WWE loved to promote the fact that they were so, that their tickets were so affordable. And that is not, I think, the motto, is written on Mark Shapiro's wall in his office.
No. Mark Shapiro, I think that's something that we've seen a difference from, right? In the leadership, I would say, from Vince to Mark Shapiro in that there are some old traditions that are being left behind. Not that those traditions, such as house shows in smaller markets, weren't wearing away over time in recent years, but especially, you know, in this era where I guess, you know, Mark Shapiro is looking at this anew and not so interested in maintaining certain traditions like going to house shows in what he called the C&D markets, or preventing sponsors from being on the canvas, which I noticed there was a Prime logo on a recent SmackDown of all things.
Yeah.
Not just PLEs, but a SmackDown. So that's what they're doing. Not to mention lots of synergy and cost cutting. And, you know, they've done a lot of layoffs, obviously, already.
Yeah. I think if Mark Shapiro has a motto, it's there's always another zero that can be added.
Yes. Sounds good.
Well, maybe WWE is looking to add some zeros in Japan, because this coming Sunday, when Noah will be holding its event at Yokohama Buntai, Grand Ship 2024 in Yokohama, they will be making an announcement in conjunction with WWE, a major announcement this coming Sunday. What it is, we will see. Of course, there is a connection through a bima between WWE and Noah, at least on broadcasters, but we will see what this means and ultimately what this means for Noah, if this is some sort of a working relationship with WWE. And certainly we now, over these last couple of months, have seen more of a strategy from WWE to be working with, albeit much smaller companies, but at least opening up their doors and working with your TNAs. We just got an announcement that they're sending Io Sky to Marigold, and you would think this would be probably something in that same vein.
So it sounds like WWE is setting up their international partners, which is something that you would not see in a Vince McMahon era, right? AEW has their international partners in terms of their partners with everybody in Mexico, AAA and CMLL. But obviously there's a strong New Japan relationship there and the beginnings of a Stardom relationship. And this is sort of the corresponding set for WWE, Noah, a male wrestler promotion, and Marigold with the women wrestlers. Is this concerning for the Japanese wrestling industry? Is this, you know, is this the Trojan horse of WWE coming into Japan to, you know, occupy one of these promotions and slowly but surely wear it away and you know, homogenize it and do damage to it, as purportedly Vince did in the 80s with the territories, and then you look at the UK indies, in which, you know, ICW and Progress were adopted as partners, WXW. They ended up on the network, WWN and Evolve, and the indies certainly are not what they were, at least in terms of those companies. WN doesn't even run shows anymore today.
Well, I feel that your response will be, that was a different era. Why are you just being so negative? Why are you being so pessimistic when it comes to WWE? They just want to help out the wrestling industry. They just want to grow things. But I would point to many, many examples, and the most current ones being what you mentioned with Progress, with Evolve. I mean, those, it was the exact same response of what will this mean for the UK independent scene? And I think we can look at what those deals really meant for those independent companies, where WWE had the ability in its contracts to purchase outright these promotions. And for a Noah, I mean, this is a company that does have a much larger entity as its parent company, but I don't foresee any of these companies turning away WWE involvement and the idea of having a guest wrestler come once a quarter or several times a year, that you would just naturally seem that they are going to jump into bed with WWE. But it certainly comes with its risk as well, about what the ultimate plan is for WWE. Is it to prop up a Noah, or is this to really get their feet on the ground with a Japanese company that can be mainly in their image and likeness?
What is the opportunity for WWE in doing this? I guess ultimately you look at, hey, look, there's a lot of pro wrestling live events that are happening all over the world that aren't WWE events. Why doesn't that money belong to us, I guess, is part of their thought process. On one hand, this is not a very lucrative business. It's a live event business, and WWE has you know, their business has been transformed over the last decade or two by media revenue, which is, you know, not as pronounced in Japan. So is that the opportunity that they're after here, is just to get the live event revenue and hopefully profit that's in abundance in Japan?
Well, I think that this is something that I think that Paul Levesque eventually very much spearheaded during his kind of last level of influence when, what was our favorite term?
Global localization.
And it very much felt that was not a priority of Vince McMahon. And I would kind of lean towards that as well, of what the upside is here as opposed to just having roots in different areas of the world. What is the cost of developing those roots versus what is the fruit that you are bringing from these different regions, as opposed to touring, or like what is the financial upside? Because these are not, I guess this is a rather safe way to go into Japan, where you are simply having a partner rather than trying to start something from scratch, which was basically the idea of this image here, was getting performance centers in different parts of the world and starting up, and that NXT UK was going to be the first of many satellite NXT operations NXT UK just disappeared, and NXT Europe is just something that is once a year we get there's still plans, still waiting on NXT Europe.
Yeah. I mean, before the pandemic, there were rumors of an NXT Japan presence of some sort. I think it's beneficial to have partners in different regions, and you can always trade talent and supplement your programs with that. Now they might look at these regions and say, well, even if they're not making that much money, imagine if they had the WWE Endeavor flywheel as a part of it. Maybe there's greater money to extract there. But as we've seen and sort of demonstrated already in the UK, and I guess you could say, well, it was interrupted by the pandemic, but it's demonstrated in the UK, their most comparable market to the domestic one, I would say, there was a reason to basically shut down the UK Performance Center and the UK NXT brand. So I think it's going to be difficult if they intend to do something beyond just a talent sharing relationship here.
What if this means Kazuyuki Fujita and R-Truth coming together as a dream pairing?
I'm all for more Kazuyuki Fujita on Raw or SmackDown. Maybe Tadao Yasuda. Who are some of the other great leaders of the Inokism era in New Japan in the
2000s? I mean, Muto is going to have his claws in this in some form.
Certainly he is. Yes, he's going to be doing his thing in front of the camera somewhere.
Do we get a Mark Shapiro Keiji Muto photo op in 2024? That's all we're really concerned about. But that announcement will be made this coming Sunday, whatever it is. And following on that, Io Sky going to the Marigold pay-per-view on July the 13th to take on Utami Hayashishida. So that is the latest on WWE, the return of global localization. We will see what other areas are in their scope in 2024. Let's move on over to AEW, and we're going to talk about the subject that we never can get enough of. That is attendance for AEW. It is not looking too promising. And this comes as we saw the major shift in the live event strategy. And this is, we're kind of wrapping up the first full quarter under what we can call the Koshe Urbe regime, after Raphael Morphy left and a lot of the shows that they had scheduled bled into the first quarter after he had left to take a job with the Barclays Center. But when you look, and this data is all coming from the great and mysterious WrestleTix that everybody should be following. When you look at these advances, Brandon, like outside of this Forbidden Door show that is approaching the 8,000 mark, like these are some pretty dire numbers over this next month that will take them into their residency at the Esports Stadium in Arlington, Texas. But we're looking at numbers that are not even sniffing 3,000 at this point. Now, some of these we still have weeks to go that we will see. But I mean, like in your neck of the woods, like we have 2,200 set for a Dynamite Collision taping at the KeyBank Center in Buffalo as just one example. And that's essentially the range. Like the high mark is Calgary with 2,600.
Yeah, and that's upcoming Calgary, right? And they did a strong number in Vancouver just to, right? Was it Vancouver not that long ago?
We had the Kia Forum show, 5,600.
In L.A., yeah.
Excluding pay-per-views. Vancouver, 6,600, which, yes, by today's standards, that was a very good figure for them.
But yeah, it's a... You know, these numbers have gone down. It looks like in this quarter, which is almost over Q2 of 2024, that these collision numbers may have finally stabilized around the 3,000 mark. But yeah, it's going back to these markets. It's going to the markets probably more often because you have another weekly touring show. And the product is not as hot as it was, last year, at least in terms of a live event. I don't know, or the year before that, when I would say AEW's absolute peak was the fall of 2021. And that's where, if you look on this chart, I think you'll see, you know, well, you see it in what, in early 2022, late, yeah, or in early 2022, where their average Dynamite attendance anyway was at its peak. It's these live events, like on their own, in terms of the money that they spend on these live events versus the revenue that they get in terms of ticket sales and merchandise. And maybe, I don't know if there's any live event sponsorships, but certainly there's tickets and merchandise. I don't think it's covering the cost, but that's not the business anymore. It's, you know, creating a TV product that your TV partners pay you tens of millions, maybe someday hundreds of millions of dollars for.
Yeah. Brandon also did a really good breakdown of some market to market comparisons year over year with Winnipeg, Edmonton, Las Vegas, and Inglewood, California, that we just mentioned. And suffice to say, they are down significant double digit figures year over year. So, I mean, it paints the picture that I think everyone sees from the perception that it is a cooler product this year around. I don't think that the live event picture is going to play much of a factor in their television negotiations, but it does tell you a larger indicator of just where AEW is. And it's like, without question, it's a cooled off product. And I would say, like, your live event business is probably your most reliable pulse on interested fan bases in terms of actually leaving their homes, spending money on the product when AEW comes to town one or two times a year.
And unlike TV ratings, there's no headwind here. You can say, well, cord cutting. If anything, I would guess that more broadly, we're seeing an increase generally in live event experiences and people spending on that. Probably look at the business of Live Nation, which I hear is doing well. What's the reason for this? Why is live event business soft, as one might say? Is it just the fact that you're increasing volume with collision added, or is it something else?
I think that you can find a lot of different anecdotal reasoning for live events. I think a consistent reason I hear from people is the lack of knowledge about what you're getting for a show. I saw Cubs fan just write about this the other day on Lucha Blog about the fact that he was considering making the trip to Collision last weekend, but Dynamite came and went. And they didn't advertise one match for Collision. And it was like, am I going to make this several hour trip to Council Bluffs, Iowa? Which, I mean, when you're putting Council Bluffs, Iowa into the GPS, that's a dedicated fan. So when you're not going off your show and telling people one match on the very next show that is just days away and relying on Twitter updates in the 24 hours beforehand, well, I think you're cutting off not your entire potential ticket buying audience, but at least some of them. That, I mean, it is about creating buzz. Like, you're 2 weeks out, Brandon, from a Buffalo show. Like, you would have no idea not only what matches you're getting, you don't even know what talent will be on that show. And I think there is something to, when a product is colder, you have to over deliver and go above and beyond. A WWE today, you can announce a show in Buffalo for September, and I think you're going to get a great response. It's a hot product. And I think there's also a confidence level that if I buy a ticket to Raw, I know I'm getting pretty much all the stars that are attached to the Raw brand, unless there is an extenuating injury situation. That's one reason I think that you're not able to get a great grasp. And it comes at a time when, you know, even with all these injuries in AEW, there's still like a fair amount of stars. But that, to me, it's not just having the ensemble of different talents, but it's also, what am I getting at this show that is going to make it worth my while to spend a night out and go to a show?
Yeah, I did see a advertisement for the AEW Buffalo show during a SmackDown broadcast. I don't know if it was this past Friday, but very recently. Of course, it's not like there were any matches announced for that.
It's just a generic commercial, like see the stars of AEW.
I think Mercedes Moné was prominently featured in the ad. I assume you'll see Daniel Garcia, who's from Buffalo. And I think, you know, the idea of promoting matches ahead of time, it requires organization and long-term planning. And I don't know if those are things that are as strong as they need to be to do more of that right now in AEW, in terms of just creatively, in terms of having those matches set in stone ahead of time, so you can even advertise them.
Well, Brandon, do you think you're going to be doing a market-to-market comparison when AEW returns to Council Bluffs, Iowa? Do you think that they will return to the Mid-America Center after Koshe Urbe gave his assessment of this past Saturday's live experience in Council Bluffs?
Yes, he tweeted, Council Bluffs, as he always does, tweet a photo of the arena. And he tweeted, Council Bluffs is home to fantastic fans, a charming city, and a subpar venue partner. For those who chose AEW Collision on TV or in person, thank you. And surely,
now, I'm sure that Brandon, he didn't mean, he typo, right? Like you're typing fast on your
iPhone.
He didn't
mean to say subpar.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, I'm sure he clarified this in the comments.
He meant to type superb, right?
Exactly.
But he did clarify that he said what he said.
Oh, wait a minute. I said what I said. So, I mean, credit to the man for being very honest about his lack of approval of the poor Mid-America Center. But I mean, that was an interesting response to the Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs, Iowa. This was a show that
not every day that you see a wrestling executive bury one of their partners.
Yeah, so that will be, I couldn't even tell you if there's a competing venue in Council Bluffs, Iowa. I would think that probably not too many options in Council Bluffs, but we will see. Hopefully they have a better go tonight in Des Moines, Iowa at the Wells Fargo Arena. But look out, okay? This guy's got, he's got his thumbs ready on Twitter in case he does not have the proper hosting etiquette of that venues should be expected to have. But it's an ongoing issue, the attendance issues. And this also comes on the heels of this Saturday. It is 1 year of AEW Collision. And the idea that it was 1 year ago of the one Bill Phil promo, that feels like 5 years in professional wrestling. But that was only 1 year ago that CM Punk was brought back to television as the anchor for this new series that they were launching on Saturday nights. And the man would be gone by the end of the summer. And where we stand with Collision 1 year in, would you look at this as, how would you grade the launch of what is the clear number two of three shows of original programming that AEW puts out each week?
When this show came out, I figured that they were trying to make this a stronger B show. I didn't expect it to be Dynamite. And I'm sure, I mean, Rampage had this same hype coming from Tony Khan as well. This is not a B show, that this is just another A show. And clearly these are two, there's a B and a C show at this point. Now it was with the assumption that CM Punk would be with AEW. Well, I don't know if it was that strong of an assumption, but the assumption that CM Punk would be with AEW and he was going to be prominently featured on this show. And this was going to be AEW's way to extract even more media revenue in the upcoming renegotiation, as we've seen how important SmackDown has been in addition to Raw in terms of WWE being able to get really strong media rights values. The show has done okay. It's probably doing substantially better than replacement programming would. Reruns of sitcoms like The Big Bang Theory or the movie reruns that are often on TNT. In terms of a rank, I think I do have the chart out here. In terms of a rank, it is averaging year to date number 18 out of all the cable originals in the demo. So that's pretty good. It's not in the top 10, but it's in the top 20 on an average basis year to date.
Wei was asking me this question. I'm curious your thoughts. Is what is the ideal night for Collision? If understanding Tony Khan's reluctance to put anything against the NFL, but even putting that aside, if there is some wiggle room to when this show could be moved, what would be
Thursday?
Optimal Thursday night, and you would go back to back.
Why is it not on Thursday currently?
What are the TNT commitments on Thursday nights?
The NBA.
So that will not be a problem in a year from now.
Or even for that matter on TBS. What's on TBS on Thursday nights? I suppose you don't want to, if you're the T-Nuts, maybe you don't want to split the male 18-49 demo on that night and have NBA and Collision. But if NBA is going away or at a minimum is no longer going to be on Thursday nights for TNT, maybe that does make that more of an option. Now, saying that, there's going to be one more NBA season of NBA on the T-Nets, and that will be into AEW's new deal, whatever it may be, assuming there is a new deal. Assuming there is a new deal with Turner. So they're going to continue to have to avoid NBA basketball if that's a priority for another year at least.
Or you go 4 hours on Wednesday nights.
Maybe. maybe a 3-hour Dynamite and a 3-hour Collision. Certainly a 3-hour.
Well, wasn't that Nick Khan's desire?
He wanted an 8-hour. An 8-hour. Raw.
That's right. That's right. Let's you just wake up and go right to Raw, and that's how you spend your day. It's interesting of where you move things around. I'd be curious how tied Tony is to the whole NFL issue at this point in time when it comes to securing a strong television deal, having this in the ideal placement, and colliding. But
if you're going to have three weekly shows, and the NFL is airing Sunday night, Monday night, Thursday night. That doesn't leave, that there's 7 days in the week. There's only so many days in the week that you can organize around.
I would love to imagine like the NFL owners all getting together, and that
I'm sure they're real worried about Collision going head to head with Amazon Prime Video's Thursday Night Football. Al Michaels is shaking in his boots.
I think they would give him a pass on that one.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, let's move on to the most focused upon state on any wrestling podcast. That is Texas. The latest, Brandon, is that you have been able to learn. You are being I would call this passive aggressive, but I think you'll be more neutral towards this. But I can share my commentary afterwards. But what have you learned about this ongoing issue, this complaint filed by WWE to try and prevent the release of these records as it relates to WrestleMania and last year's Royal Rumble in the state of Texas?
There's a lot of complexity here, and I'm afraid that I'm going to go into too much detail and just lose people. But so I've been making public records requests. This is principally about the Royal Rumble in 2023 in San Antonio. So not this year's Rumble, but the one before. The one was in San Antonio at the Alamo Dome. Looks like there was a site fee associated with it. I did make a records request way back then, the night of the event, and they did give me attendance figures and things of that nature, which we already reported on over a year ago. But what they didn't want to give me was that, what's called, I don't know, the Alamo Dome leasing contract or something to that effect. The agreement between the city and or the venue and WWE, which apparently would reveal the site fee information or the bidding information that was related to this event. So As listeners know, there's a lawsuit because the Attorney General ruled that you have to release that information. City of San Antonio, you have to release that information. W said, no, we're going to sue the Attorney General over this to try to withhold this. That lawsuit is ongoing still. And I've also, I decided to make a request to the governor's office because I believe that the governor's office will have record of this as well. So I've made that request, and W's attorneys, they've got a Holland and Knight, their attorneys working with them on this issue. And they have written a letter to the Attorney General because this, of course, has to go to Attorney General review to rule whether or not this information has to be released. And they wrote a letter on May 31st. I received it on Monday. They're required by law, required by law to give the requester. So that's an important word in this story today. Remember the word requester. That's me.
The requester.
The requester. That's my new moniker. They're required by Texas law to give the requester a copy of any third party letter to the Attorney General where they say, this is why you shouldn't release this information because it's special and privileged. So they wrote this letter. They gave it to me on Monday, and it looks like there's an email chain where it looks like they tried to send it to me on the day that they sent it to the Attorney General. But they forgot to like include my email address. In any case, here's what they say. They point out to the Attorney General, they're currently involved in this lawsuit, and they point out that Mr. Thurston did not intervene in that lawsuit. More on that later. But they pointed out that the document that I'm looking for is this licensing agreement, and it'll reveal all this information that we don't want to reveal. Okay. And there is, as people may remember, I was talking about this story before, they're saying that this is confidential information because it's proprietary, because it's a trade secret, and oh, this new third reason, which they did not raise in response to my request for the WrestleMania 38 information, but they did in the case of the Royal Rumble information, they raised that this also should be exempt because it falls under something called common law privacy. Now, we'll explain what that is, but they do say if it doesn't fall under these exemptions, W proposes releasing a copy of the production, presumably that means the agreement, with WWE's confidential information redacted. Redacting WWE's specific proprietary information protects WWE's interests as a private third party while still providing the requester with the documents he seeks. So they are proposing this alternative where if the Attorney General says no to this certain exemption, then they would put it out redacted with certain information withheld still. In any case, they go on and say, what's the part that I want to get to here is that information is accepted from mandatory disclosure as confidential if, this is like reading directly from the law, the information contains highly intimate or embarrassing facts, the publication of which would be highly objectionable to a reasonable person, and two, the information is not of legitimate concern to the public. So I believe they're quoting from case law there, a case from 1976. In any case, they go on to say the financial terms W seeks to protect fall within this common law standard. The terms represent crucial negotiated information that would expose W in future negotiations with other parties. They're talking about their site fee negotiations and reveal closely held financial information about a private company. Further, these negotiated terms are not of legitimate concern to the public. The requester in this case is interested only in uncovering WWE's private information, not in pursuing transparency from a governing body, end quote. So clearly they're not listening to this podcast, or maybe they are today. Who knows? And I could not help but think. Yeah, go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
Well, I was just going to say that it's quite something for WWE to make the argument that these are not in the public interest. That is not for them to determine in this case. That is for a neutral third party to decipher what.
And that's what the AG is for, I suppose.
Yeah. And that's what it is for. But I would also love to parse how you differentiate between this person is only interested in private information versus serving the public, because I think like there's a lot of parsing that you have to do to be able to separate that and make that obviously they're trying to paint this as you are simply just trying to get information that is of no value to the public that is somehow of value to you and you alone versus doing the public good, and they are pushing back on this. But I thought you had a pretty strong response to this in terms of breaking it down in a very, I would say, very, very eloquent way.
And I have to mention, too, I couldn't help but read that line and think of the comments that were said about our friend John Rezzi by media critic and attorney Jerry McDivitt in 1992, where he said that Arezzi has no, he was criticizing the wrestling media, basically saying Arezzi has no known job and was a member of the so-called wrestling media, a group of people relied upon by Mushnick and in a form of lowest common denominator journalism. These members of the wrestling media generally have no real assets, no regular job, and literally spend their lives searching for and printing any rumor, gossip, or dirt about wrestling that they can find. These are Jerry McDivitt's words in 1992. At least they stopped short of saying anything to that effect. An evolution in W's opposition to the wrestling media, I suppose. So I wrote them a letter. I feel like I've been talking about this for a long time already, I'll try to go through it quickly. I noted that I first received a copy of this on June 10th, which is Monday, and I noted that the reason why I didn't intervene in this lawsuit is because, you know, I don't work for the New York Times or the Washington. I didn't say it like this, but I don't work for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. I'm an independent reporter, and I cannot afford to spend what I think would be tens of thousands of dollars to intervene in a case like this and hire a lawyer. And W though certainly does. And I just pointed out, and I attached the earlier ruling from earlier this year, where the Assistant Attorney General in that situation decided that W did not meet the exemptions. They said that W failed to demonstrate that the information at issue here qualifies for these exemptions. And I said that the assertion that I'm interested only in uncovering W's private information and not pursuing transparency from a governing body is entirely false. My objective is to ensure transparency from the city of San Antonio and the office of the governor regarding the government's spending of W's Royal Rumble event. This transparency serves the public interest by allowing taxpayers to evaluate whether their money was wisely spent and if the price paid aligns with other site fees and the economic impacts of similar events. Reporting what San Antonio paid for the Royal Rumble is crucial for the citizens and taxpayers of San Antonio, potentially all Texans, if state funds were used, which I suspect they were. Transparency in event pricing benefits municipalities and citizens more broadly who may negotiate with WWE for future events and, in fact, are probably negotiating with them right now. WWE and its parent company TKO have publicly stated that this is a big key growth opportunity for them. So the prices basically, I think, are not well defined. There isn't a great understanding about what the fair value is of this. And if this information is withheld, there will be a weaker understanding about what the fair price is for these events. And if municipalities overpay or pay more, that is to the detriment of taxpayers when taxpayer money could go to other things. And I'm not saying that these events aren't worth it. And they, you know, if you believe the economic impact reports, and if you just kind of do the math on the hotel tax for one thing, it's probably worth it and then some. But if governments can pay a little less for that, and can spend a little bit more on things like social programs or helping people in need, then they ought to be able to do that. And transparency should only help governments get a fair price for these events.
I think if you were to pull citizens versus corporations and ask them, are you concerned about where your taxpayer dollars are going? Is this important or not? I think you're going to get differing answers based on those entities. And then the question would become, if this is not to the benefit of the public interest, what level would it have to reach? Like, if we were talking about taxpayer dollars supporting how many examples do you have of cities that have pushed back when taxpayers don't want to contribute to a new sports stadium? Now, this is not that level of cost, but that is a massive issue that has led to teams having to leave cities because taxpayers don't want their money going towards something like that. So if we are talking about that is of grand public interest and this is of nothing, there's something in between there. And there is a very easy remedy for TKO to be able to keep all of their chips close to themselves and hide their finances. And that is, do not seek public funds for this. But you're indicating that not only are these the funds you're seeking, you are looking to grow these over time and be able to secure these funds for regular televised events like Raw and SmackDown that you're looking for as well. So I think this is a really important story. It's going to get almost no mileage because this is not the most sexy of topics, but it's
you can read the article right now on WrestleNomics.com, by the way. You can share it if you want.
You should be, and I'm fine talking about this every single week because I think this is a really important story because I think a win here does kind of set the precedent that they can take to all other states, and it's an easy rubber stamp that this will be in WWE's negotiations that they don't have to have this fight at the end of it. It is made clear that we're coming and we want no transparency as it relates to any of the territories that we run, whether it be domestic or abroad, so that the Brandon Thurstons of the world don't even have step one to try and acquire this information. I think it's a very important case.
Yeah, it seems that they want there to be, they argue in their petition, in their lawsuit, in this letter about protecting their bargaining power. And I think you could, from the opposite point of view, which I suppose I represent, you could say, well, the bargaining power, what you call bargaining power, is just, you know, the opaque pricing that you want to maintain so that governments don't know what other governments are paying for comparable events so that you can charge a higher price at the expense of taxpayers. I will say, when I read this on Monday evening, I was very motivated to write a letter, as you were having to watch, I suppose, Monday Night Raw. I was busy on my laptop as I did feel, you know, I felt insulted that they would say that I was only looking to, you know, report their private business information, and that this was of no public interest. And this was not about transparency of government, when we've been saying for weeks, I've been, I think, articulating this for weeks, that's why this is important. It's one thing to report on attendance and gate figures, and that's all fun and well and good. But this is a higher priority when we're talking about how our citizens' tax dollars being spent, and shouldn't they be allowed to know how they're being spent and whether it is a fair price, whether it aligns with the other site fees that are out there and what those events have delivered. It makes me think that maybe that is the reason why there was that other exemption raised in this case of this request and not in the WrestleMania request, and that maybe they were miffed that I made a request for the same information about which there was already a lawsuit happening, which I did. I was transparent about in my request, and I said, this is the lawsuit that's happening related to this information. I wasn't trying to withhold that or pull a fast one.
You also got more information out of Pennsylvania as it relates to WrestleMania, and you have a story coming up in about 10 minutes at WrestleNomics.com. We can put the countdown ticker in the upper right hand corner.
Yes, we have more documents
here.
As we got, this is from the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission. So basically, we've already reported what the gate figures were for all of the WrestleMania events and the surrounding events at Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. So we knew what the gates were. We didn't know what the ticket sales numbers were. What we've got now are the ticket sales numbers. So this is the WrestleMania Night 1. So we now know that the number of tickets sold for WrestleMania Night 1 was 56,000. WrestleMania Night 2, 56,147. That's the number of paid ticket sales. 56,147 for Night 1. For Night 2, 56,758. There were a few hundred comps. I'll list all the information in the article and on the screen in a moment. But I was perplexed by this extra record that I got for an event happening on April 4th, which I had to look up, was a Thursday. It drew a gate of $180,000. It happened at 29 East Allen Street in Philadelphia, which is not the address of Wells Fargo Center. Certainly not the address of Lincoln Financial Field. Do you have any guess what this event was that was sanctioned by the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission?
29 East Allen Street. I have
$180,000 gate.
Was this at the Fillmore?
This was at the Fillmore. And for whatever reason,
my goodness.
This ran, there were no matches, right? There was no ring or matches at the Undertaker One Dead Man Show, correct?
I didn't even think about this event, which just came and went in Philadelphia. But
nonetheless,
how much was the gate for this?
$180,000.
$180,000. Okay. Take that, Luthez and Baron Leone in 1953.
$100,000 gate. Yeah, and not for nothing. So the reason, what the commission does here is they take a 5% tax on all ticket sales. So despite there being no matches here, I don't think they needed to. Who knows what the bylaws say? They got a 5% tax on the Undertaker one man show, basically, in addition to WrestleMania and the surrounding events. So the state, just through commission taxes, collected over $2 million because of WWE events. So we can say, look at that as a local government economic positive impact as well, and that they generated an extra $2 million for the state here.
That's an astounding number that they drew for this Undertaker show. That, I mean, they quietly piggyback a lot of the big shows with these Undertaker one-man shows, but they're very like small venues that they book. But I mean, look at like the average ticket price here, like $194 to watch The Undertaker. I'm sure some of these have like some special packages attached to them, but it's like that's an incredible figure when you compare it. Like that is a higher average ticket than all the secondary WWE events that weekend. Granted, it's a smaller number, but man, that's like, we don't even talk about this event over WrestleMania weekend as anything of like note, but that's a very impressive figure that they were able to draw.
Yeah, I would venture to guess that that's probably a higher gate than any non-WWE show. Well, but there's the Ring of Honor show that might have drawn in that neighborhood. But it's a very high gate, despite, you know, there's only the ticket sold number was 928. That's higher than I would have guessed to fit that many people in a nightclub. But there you go.
A few other notes here before we wrap things up. So I don't know how much this is going to like impact things in Canada, but this is noteworthy that Rogers Communications, which is the company that houses many networks, including Rogers Sportsnet, which houses the WWE and UFC programming currently, announced on Monday a blockbuster multi-year deal with NBC Universal and Warner Brothers Discovery to bring the most watched lifestyle and entertainment content to Canadians on their platform of choice. Starting in September, the company is launching NBC Universal's Bravo channel in Canada and will become the English language television content rights holder in Canada, featuring the best of unscripted programming, which will include new seasons of Bravo's hit franchise series. In January of 2025, Rogers will be the home of Warner Brothers Discovery's suite of English language lifestyle and factual brands, including HGTV, The Food Network, and more. Rogers will work with Canadian distribution partners to make the content widely available so viewers can continue to watch the programs they have come to know and love. So I don't know how much this will affect things. The AEW deal is currently with TSN. My understanding is that it will be, I don't know when the exact end date is, but when it is expired, Rogers Sportsnet is losing all of its WWE programming effective January 1st. They'll still have the UFC, but no WWE programming. And does this new agreement with Warner Brothers Discovery, does that at all create a pathway for a transition of AEW's programming to Rogers Sportsnet, which may be a better home for them where they could actually have dedicated television coverage to all of their programming, because as of now it is only Dynamite that you can watch on TSN proper. You need an extra digital package for its Collision and Rampage programming.
Now, I don't see any mention of TNT or TBS here.
No, there's nothing involving that. It is a deal though with Warner Brothers Discovery programming.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that what's the networks that are called out here are the former Discovery networks, HGTV and the Food Network. So I don't know if you're going to get any form of TNT or TBS here.
No, I don't think it's going to contain the channels, but it does at least create a relationship with Warner Brothers Discovery. And I question, too, for TSN, like what their future is with professional wrestling of AEW as well. But that will be an interesting, like many networks out there that are losing WWE is, and Canada is one where one is expiring with WWE, and it'll be right around the time that AEW could be on the market. So something to keep an eye on in Canada. Have you kept up at all with Who Killed WCW, Brandon?
I watched most of the first episode. I understand the second episode aired last night, though.
Yeah, we're into the steep decline now of 1998, 1999. Defenders of the Finger Poke of Doom galore. Mm. And that is where we are at right now. But it is certainly an interesting series so far, I would say. Well, what did you think so far of episode one? Who came off well? Anything that was of interest to you that kept your interest?
I don't know if I could tell you one memory I have of it.
We'll put that quote on the poster.
It seemed like a well done documentary. I think I had it on in the background while I was doing other stuff, but no strong thoughts.
Well, I think episode three is the introduction of Vince Russo. So I'm sure that will be okay. A very, very measured, nuanced discussion of WCW from 1999 and 2000. I'm sure everyone will be in complete agreement. It will be some very, complimentary.
Will be a vote at the end or something?
I think so. I think you get to, it'll be like Survivor where you get like a piece of parchment to write the person's name that you're going to vote off the island, and we'll have one sole person accused of killing WCW. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be this guy, Dick Cheatham. I think he's just lurking in the shadows. I think he's going to reveal it right at the end.
No Jamie Kellner.
Jamie Kellner was not, he was apparently asked to be interviewed, and he's, according to Brian Gewirtz, the response he got was, why does anyone want to keep talking about this stuff all these years later? So that was Jamie Kellner's response to being interviewed, which is funny because Guy Evans did interview him in his book. And that, to my knowledge, is the only interview Jamie Kellner has done about WCW.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm hesitant to ever talk that much about stuff like that happened before 2015, because I feel there's so many people who know these subjects so much better. But it's a combination of the decline of the popularity and the ratings of the product, and TV executives not being that enthusiastic. Oh, okay. Here's a memory I can conjure up from watching it, in that they had, like, was it a finance guy from Turner talking about how if you did anything to try to support or help this project, it would be political death for you with Turner, because there were so many people opposed to it, but it was happening nonetheless because of Ted Turner's support for it.
Well, episode 3 and 4, they're coming up on Vice TV. And yes, we are doing reviews for them on the Post Wrestling Cafe, myself and Wei Ting, if you want to hear some of our thoughts about the episodes that are going on. But that's going to bring an end. We have gone through all of our topics for another week. We will be back next week. Lucas Sharpio scheduled to join us next week after Clash at the Castle, which is going down this Saturday from Glasgow, Scotland. It might be on in the background as Brandon is requesting away. He has been dubbed here by King of the North, the requester, Brandon.
Is it T-E-R or T-O-R at the end?
Oh, he gave you an E-R here.
I don't know.
There you have it.
You know, what we didn't talk about is the announced attendance of WrestleMania versus what we now know to be, what we could say is the actual, not the estimate, but the actual tickets distributed. They announced well over 72,000 each night. Tickets distributed for each night was just over 60,000. So now we don't have suites here in all likelihood.
I was in those suites. I don't think there were 12,000 people spread out.
There were definitely hundreds in the suites.
There were definitely hundreds, but I don't think there were 12,500 and some odd people put up in those suites.
So who knows what the math was here? Unfortunately, Lincoln Financial Field, I don't think is a government building, so I don't know that we're going to be able to extract the formula that was used.
Yes, that was a... That was the cap off at the press conference. They were going to let 11,000 people into the press conference, but I was number 12,000. Yes. I was out of the numbered game, as it were. But there you have it. Yeah, quite the disparity between numbers there, from tickets distributed to the actual number. But nonetheless, we will still have that 140,000 number. I'm sure that will be go down in history as the official one. You always got to pay attention to that asterisk.
And these are, we should not point out that these are the number one and number two highest gates of all time in pro wrestling history, not adjusting for inflation, but in terms of real time dollars, these are number one and number two.
The two biggest shows in the history of professional wrestling happened at Lincoln Financial Field up until the next year's Las Vegas show, probably.
And we were there working on our laptops.
Did you, last topic, did you see any of the UFC Apex NXT show?
I did see Sunday? A bit of it. I thought it looked all right. I heard that people were disappointed with it relative to the PC experience, though. Not the attendees, but the TV experience.
I heard different reactions from people. Those that just watch like the fight nights, and like it was a marked improvement over the UFC fight nights in that venue. Like in that way, they had many more people than you get at an Apex. They were also, it looked a lot more spruce.
There were risers here, whereas I don't know what the seating arrangement is like for the UFC events.
My takeaway would be, if you are WWE, like certainly these were high price tickets, as I understand. And obviously there is the synergy of doing these at the Apex. They would not be my preferred method. You're sacrificing a lot in terms of the atmosphere even you have at the Performance Center. However, another takeaway would be, if you were the UFC and you watch this, I think you would state, we can do a lot more with these, but they are much more less inclined for, the atmosphere has been experienced at the Apex, that there has been very little that they have changed since the pandemic to these Apex shows, that in one night WWE showed that even in this environment, you can do a bit more with that. I think they would, it would be an interesting question if they could even get that many people on a routine basis in Vegas to come out for fight nights. But it was an interesting experiment, but one where, you were giving up certain aspects when you could have taken this to many arenas and done a few thousand people for sure.
I wonder if maybe what they're thinking in terms of synergy is over time. I mean, this would be a big move because it's where people live, but why is there a performance center when there's a UFC Apex? Why do we have two of these facilities that couldn't be one?
I think you would certainly think that way. And kind of goes counter to this whole like international idea of like you keep hearing Dana White talking about opening up Apexes all over the place. And I mean, in certain places, I'm sure that there is logical sense for them, but these are not cheap investments either. And if you look in the US, I think you're right, Brandon, like you have two facilities that essentially serve this exact same function for both of your properties, and would one be sufficient? Have Norman Smiley leading the jiu-jitsu classes. I mean, we could just mix and match.
Imagine that. It will inevitably lead to some sort of work shoot style, off brand for WWE or for TKO for that matter.
That's right. Okay. We could do contender series where Dana picks, the winners go to UFC, the losers get NIL deals with WWE.
And we've already got a tacit endorsement from Nick Khan, who has attended a Bloodsport event.
That's right. That's right. I wonder if he's flying to Japan in a few weeks for the next Bloodsport.
Who knows? Hopefully.
All right.
We'll have to look. Where is it? Is that a Corkin Hall or something?
I think it's a Corkin. Okay. I'd have to check the location, but they got Moxley on that show. Santino Morella's on that show. So
I have to look. I have to look around, look in the back of the building.
If only they could have coordinated this NOAH announcement with the Bloodsport the next weekend. I mean, this could have been perfect for them timing-wise. All right, that's going to wrap things up for us, everybody. Wei Ting and I are back tonight with Rewind to Dynamite, 10 Eastern on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. You can follow us as well, postwrestlingcafe.com, and support the requester himself. Give him the rocket fuel he needs to be seeking out all of these records at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And Brandon will be back with another show this coming Sunday on the WrestleNomics Patreon feed, 11 a.m. Eastern time.
Yes. Tune in.
Yes. For the post Clash at the Castle review by Brandon, he will go match by match and discuss the fallout from Scotland. Does Drew McIntyre win the big one?
No. There will be PowerPoint slides. That's what there will be.
Look out for it. Sunday morning, and that is it for us. So thanks to everyone for tuning in, and we'll speak with you next Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern. Goodbye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.